Robert Barry is a conceptual artist that came of age in the 1960s in New York City. Barry's best-known works of art employ text and images altering size, scale, and medium for varying effect. They frequently appear sparse, are often intangible and imperceptible, and are sometimes only fleetingly visible. As a result, Barry's works appear unknowable and are a challenge to viewers who seek to understand them. Today, we shall consider the medium of projected light in famous paintings as a producer of meaning and as generative of a certain kind of bodily experience. Using philosopher Maurice Merleau-Ponty's phenomenological approach to the perception of objects in space, I argue that the import of Barry's projection can best be understood by the way a viewer relates to and perceives the work. To use Merleau-Ponty's term, the projection honeys the viewer. Merleau-Ponty stresses the ability of human beings to come to know the world through embodied perception. He asserts that an individual, by virtue of being embedded in the world, has access to the truth of the world. Similarly, a viewer's embeddedness in famous paintings, a similar work of which is seen here, may provide access to the work's truth. The light projection in famous paintings involves the viewer in the work so that both viewer and artwork are transformed and are endowed with meaning through the experiential process. The medium of projected light, the embedded viewer experience, and the embodied perception all contribute to the experience of famous paintings, which I argue shapes both artwork and viewer in a meaningful manner. Barry began incorporating text into his artworks in the mid-1970s, creating what critic Robert C. Morgan coined word-image constructs, of which famous paintings is a prime example. The work is composed of words and images projected onto the wall as slides at equal intervals. A slide projector on a pedestal in the center of the room projects 81 slides in a dimly lit gallery space, alternating from a blank slide to a word, to another blank slide, to an image, and so on, with no clear beginning or end. The list of words is largely constituted of vaguely connotative terms, which suggest possible associations between the images and the other words, such as private, correspond, shift, and modern. The words are projected in white lowercase letters on a black background in a traditional Times New Roman typeface. The images, on the other hand, are sepia-toned reproductions, low-quality reproductions, I'll add, of masterpieces from Western art, identified by their title, the name of the artist, and an arbitrarily assigned number. Although Merleau-Ponty's lectures on phenomenology aired over French radio waves in 1948, and his main opus, The Phenomenology of Perception, was published in 1945, nearly three decades before Barry made famous paintings, I believe this philosophy is nevertheless a useful analytical tool for understanding a viewer's experience of the work. The central theme of Merleau-Ponty's philosophy considers the phenomenon of the body as it relates to, interprets, encounters, and responds to the world. Thus, quote, "Our embodiment brings to our perceptual experience an a priori structure, whereby it presents itself to us in our consciousness as experience of a world of things in space and time whose nature is independent of us," unquote. In other words, our experience of the world around us is independent of us, and it presents itself to us as such in our consciousness. Only through the awareness of this perceptual process and through becoming aware of this process, which is what Merleau-Ponty calls radical reflection, does one recognize that man is a mind with a body, not a mind and a body, and is thus, quote, "a being who can only get to the truth of things because its body is, as it were, embedded in those things," unquote. In order for us to become aware of this phenomenon of embodied perception, we must become detached from ordinary sensory experience. the vacillation between normal perception or sensory experience and then the radical reflection upon this sensory experience produces an awareness of our embeddedness in the world, and by extension allows us to come to know the world. In the case of famous paintings, when a viewer is embedded into the work and radically reflects upon the experience of the work, he or she approaches knowledge of the work that's only available to those who are embedded in the work. For Merleau-Ponty, modern art was uniquely able to bring about radical reflection because it calls attention to our perception. Paintings by Cézanne are of particular interest to the philosopher because he argues that they draw attention to our visual capabilities and limitations, and they interrupt the normal process of seeing. Modern art's mode of expression, quote, forces us to enter into the artwork, unquote, and discover its essential structure. Describing the bodily experience of space, Merleau-Ponty wrote that a being exists in space, not detached from it, but embodied within it, and intimately tied to it. For him, space begins as the zero point, or the degree zero of spatiality. Quote, I do not see it, it being space, I do not see it according to its exterior envelope. I live in it from the inside. I am immersed in it, unquote. A viewer of famous paintings is embedded within the space of the gallery in which the work is projected, and from that point of view is uniquely able to access the truth of the work. Whether the truth of the work provides a satisfactory explanation or meaning in the vernacular sense of the term is not in question here. Instead, and more significantly, the truth can be taken to mean that the embedded viewer experiences the reality of the artwork insofar as it is a vaguely connotative open text that inspires the viewer to seek relationships or connections without providing resolution. The work, made up of 81 slides, gains meaning through the syntactical relationships established in this temporal projection and the lateral relation of the slides. Multi-directional possibilities extending from image to text, from image to image, from text to text, and finally from text to image, ceaselessly open the possible meanings and variable experiences of the work of art. Were these slides exhibited independently, the slides would have vastly different meanings. Similarly, each would be almost devoid of meaning if considered separately from the reactions that they provoke in our bodies. This is to say that if the work were not installed in the gallery and thus unperceived, it would be nearly emptied of meaning, except perhaps in the mind of the artist. Instead, within the context of the work and within the gallery installation, each slide and each of its qualities have an affective meaning, which establishes a correspondence between it and the qualities associated with the other slides. With regard to the slide displaying a detail of Hieronymus Bosch's The Garden of Earthly Delights, for example, one could argue that its many qualities consist of its being numbered 14, being a Renaissance painting, a religious painting, a moralizing painting, and so on. Each of these qualities establishes a correspondence with the other qualities of the Bosch projection, as well as the qualities of the text and image projections that both precede and succeed it, not to mention the quality of the space in the gallery itself and the light that produces these images. As all of these correspondences within the work cause the individual slides and the whole work of art to gain meaning, the viewer, as an embodied subject, also imparts certain qualities that affect the meaning of the work. The viewer's subjective experiences and background contribute to the manner in which the work is viewed and interpreted. Thus, certain qualities of the slides and of the work as a whole are privileged while others are ignored, depending on the particular resonances and reflections between viewer and object. Merleau-Ponty, quoting Sartre, writes that the unity of an object lies in each of its qualities. Therefore, every separate attribute, quote, reveals the being, unquote, of the object as a whole. Given that some of these qualities are individual to the particular viewer, it follows that the object as a whole is different for each viewer, the work therefore being changed in every different circumstance of viewing. Just as the subjective viewer contributes to the meaning of a work of art, so too does the work's medium. The projector, the wall, the light, all contribute to the constitution of meaning, and more importantly for the purposes of this analysis, the experience of the work. The projection of slides in famous paintings ties the viewer into the work through its emanation of light waves across the space in which the viewer is embedded. As previously suggested, this projection honeys the viewer. Merleau-Ponty describes honey in the following way. Honey is a slow-moving liquid. While it undoubtedly has a certain consistency and allows itself to be grasped, it soon creeps slyly from the fingers and returns to where it started from. It comes apart as soon as it has been given a particular shape. And what is more, it reverses the roles by grasping the hands of whoever would take hold of it. The living, exploring hand, which thought it could master this thing, instead discovers that it is embroiled in a sticky external object. Thus, honeying is an interaction between an embodied subject and an active object, in which the object takes the shape of, grasps onto, and resists the subject. This honeying is a result of the dialogue between this embodied subject and the object which honeys. Borrowing again from Sartre, Merleau-Ponty writes of a, quote, surreptitious appropriation of the possessor by the possessed, unquote. This dialogue between the projected slides and the viewer is most readily observed if the viewer's body actually interrupts the trajectory of light from the projector to the wall. The viewer then becomes the receiver of light information, the viewer's body, and becomes intimately tied into the projection of the work. By entering this gallery space, the viewer is subjected to this potential interaction. The light itself is an aspect of the work of art that is formed by the projection and ordered by the wall, which communicates these images and texts to the viewer or onto the viewer. If the viewer should choose to walk around the gallery in a manner that elides the light's trajectory, the viewer's body can still be interpreted as having been honeyed, since he or she takes a particular action as a result of the artwork's imposition on the body. Thus, even the viewer who does not interrupt the trajectory of light waves is still embedded within and controlled by the honeying work of art. And their experience of the work is a result of this honeyed perception. When a viewer's body interrupts the trajectory of light, his or her body casts a shadow upon the wall, which obscures a portion of the projection which is in his or her own bodily form. Upon seeing this shadow or this interruption of light, the viewer may direct his or her attention towards the source of light, the projector, their concentration having been drawn to the artwork's medium. As to a newly released prisoner from Plato's allegorical cave, the glaring light might distress the viewer and perhaps momentarily inhibit their vision. Through the realization of the work's substance, initiated by the attention paid to the projector and its glaring light, he or she would become aware of the reality of the work of art, including its medium, and their sensory experience of the work. This realization leads to the radical reflection that Merleau-Ponty posits is required for a meaningful experience of the world. Merleau-Ponty's theory about the phenomenology of perception is predicated on the idea that we apprehend objects with our bodily experience of them, and that as a result, the truth of a thing can be intuited by embodied perception. Merleau-Ponty's line of reasoning leads to the question of how one's apprehension of famous paintings allows the viewer to grasp the artwork's essence. If, as Merleau-Ponty argues, the truth of a thing can be grasped through bodily perception, then the viewer of famous paintings can intuit the artwork's truth, which is, among other things, that the work is a heterotopic challenge to various language systems. The sociologist Michel Foucault believed that knowledge is a form of power that impresses itself on the body of its subject. In this context, we can understand this to mean that the work of art itself is a form of knowledge that impresses itself on the viewer. We have already explored how famous paintings literally impresses itself on the viewer. Therefore, it is necessary to understand what type of knowledge this work of art represents. Foucault uses the term heterotopia to describe linguistic mechanisms that, quote, secretly undermine language, destroy syntax in advance, and contest the very possibility of language at its source. And he used Magritte's This Is Not a Pipe as an example of a heterotopia. The heterotopic environment of famous paintings undermines three language systems: the English language system, the language and conventions of the gallery display, and the language and conventions of art history. The longer one looks at a heterotopic work of art, the more confounded one becomes. For example, when one enters the gallery, when a detail of Bosch's The Garden of Earthly Delights is momentarily projected on the wall, the image then disappears, and after a brief moment, the word searcher appears. Shortly after, this word too disappears. Perhaps the searcher appeared in the Bosch painting. Did the viewer miss the searcher? Is the viewer being called a searcher? Is the viewer being told to search? In the moment the viewer considers all or one of these possibilities, a reproduction of Vincent van Gogh's schoolboy appears to further complicate this scenario. Perhaps the schoolboy is the searcher. Does he search for knowledge? Is the viewer supposed to search for a connection between the Dutch Renaissance artist's rendition of The Last Judgment and the Dutch post-impressionist portrait of a boy? As the viewer considers all of these possibilities, the word recur appears on the wall, and the cycle thus continues. The confusion and multiplicity in the above scenario is a result of the juxtaposition and words and images, the equivocal nature of their representation, as well as the different modes of perception one employs while viewing the work of art. The viewer of the images is also in the same moment the reader of the text, just as the reader of the images is the viewer of the text. Text and image are rendered unhierarchical arbitrary signs as they lose their referential anchor and enter into heterotopic similitude with limitless possibilities for meaning and an intriguing yet confounding dearth of answers to the viewer's questions. Words and images undermine one another and together undermine the three language systems the work of art employs. It undermines the literalness of the English language in which the words are written. As such conventions are undermined, the viewer becomes aware of the fallacy of the immediacy of language. The language of the gallery discourse is similarly undermined. The work installed in a gallery is imbued with an authoritative curatorial voice. But as all of these references undermine one another, as the associative relationships between the slides self-destruct, this artistic or curatorial voice loses its power and appears choked. Barry's work at once asserts and disrupts the implicit authority of the gallery space by employing the authoritative voice in the manner of institutional critique. And finally, Barry's appropriation of masterpieces from the canon of Western art history undermines the canon of art history itself. Robert S. Nelson defines the act of appropriation as, quote, as taking, quote, something for one's own use, unquote, and as, quote, an active, subjective, and motivated act. The masterpieces Barry appropriated once signified any number of social or cultural aspects relating to their production. In the context of famous paintings, the masterpieces, now mere signs, refer instead only to one another, to the textual signifiers projected before and after them, and only loosely to their historical and original context. By appropriating the images and incorporating them into this work, Barry asserts the works are artistic masterpieces, an assertion bolstered by labeling them as if they were in a catalog, and also by the title of the work itself. Yet the vague allusions and connotations that surround them render each projected image a mere sign in this heterotopic system. Barry thus takes the high art and renders it a sign with no fixed external referent. These three challenges posed by the artwork, which confound and perplex the viewer, are also part of the work's truth that is impressed upon the viewer's body as an embodied subject. When a viewer is honeyed into the work of art, he or she recognizes these various challenges and the effect the challenges have upon their cognition. He or she sees him or herself perceiving, questioning the institution in which he or she stands, questioning the language, and questioning the language of art history. One becomes aware of one's own perception when the structures upon which their perception relies are challenged. This is what Merleau-Ponty argues happens with modern art. It is with this detached point of view that arises from the distrust of our own perception that affords us a view into a thing's truth. Thus, famous paintings, by its heterotopic nature, allows the viewer to access its truth in his or her own consciousness. Merleau-Ponty's phenomenological argument stresses the knowability of objects through embodied perception. By combining this theory with Foucault's idea of knowledge impressed upon the body, especially when we consider the notion of the heterotopic work of art, it becomes evident that although Barry's artworks are often predicated on their unknowability, looking at the work from this perspective allows a viewer to come to know the truth of the work, or at least an aspect of the truth of the work, which relates to its substance, not to artistic intention or to its meaning in a vernacular sense. Through the various mechanisms Barry uses to undermine language and to draw attention to perception, Barry exemplifies Merleau-Ponty's argument that modern art is uniquely able to demonstrate to us that our perception is embodied. Thank you.